Interview with John Huber, June 2nd, 2009, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr. First, but... Alright. Well, take me back, real quickly, let's cover your background. Education, law school, those sorts of things.
Okay.
What did you do, your undergraduate?
Undergraduate was University of Wisconsin. I graduated in 3 years instead of four. I wanted to get a master's degree before going to law school and got drafted instead. And so from March of 1969 to May of 1972, I was in the United States Army, after which I went back to the University of Wisconsin, started law school in the summer of 1972 and graduated in December of 1974.
Okay.
While I was at the commission, it was something that a lot of staff people did was to take courses at the Georgetown University Law Center. And since I still had GI Bill money, I was able to get a master's degree in tax from Georgetown. And the reason why I did that was not to become a tax lawyer. When you're an examiner in the Division of Corporation Finance, one of the things that you're doing is asking people about structure of mergers and reorganizations and complicated transactions, and the answer that always came back from counsel to the company was tax. And you didn't want to seem like an idiot. So, quite frankly, I went and started taking tax courses at Georgetown, and it was a lot of fun. And at that time, the commission was on North Capitol Street, and Georgetown was a block away, so a whole bunch of us would take courses at Georgetown at night, and I got a master's in tax from there.
The commission
The commission did not pay. The fact of the matter is, it was a bone of large contention, okay, amongst all of us. I mean, I was a veteran. I could pay GI Bill, have the GI Bill pay for the tuition. It also wasn't that big at that time. In other words, the bill wasn't that big.
Right.
But the fact is, and it's a huge fact, you had young attorneys doing this on their own ticket. And one of the things that I did when I got to be a supervisor was I taught at Georgetown. I taught at Georgetown and at AU at night. And at Georgetown, I, let's put it this way, made sure that any SEC person who wanted to audit my course could do so for free. And so at the very end, when I left the commission in 1986, the last semester that I was teaching, it was a seminar on corporate reorganization. It was tender offers, mergers, and proxy contests, that sort of thing. There were almost 80 people in the course, and a good chunk of them were SEC people. And I kept telling the commission, and at that time, the commission's budget was much smaller than it is today, that if you want to, A, have lawyers who compete with private practitioners, make sure that they can go and take these courses if they want to take them, because Georgetown's graduate program was top flight, okay? And for these courses were taught by the people that, like ERISA. I'll give you an example. When I took the ERISA course, it was taught by the person that drafted ERISA, okay?
Yeah, location has got a lot to do with that.
And so when I started teaching at Georgetown and at AU to supplement my income at the Securities and Exchange Commission, it was the kind of thing where I not only encouraged SEC people to take these courses, but I hired people from these courses. It was the best way of interviewing that you could possibly imagine, was to have students take your course and then give them an offer to come to Corp Fin after the course.
Tell me a little bit about your decision to come to the SEC. Had you developed an interest in securities law previous to that?
Yeah, since the age of 12. You really want to hear this?
Just give me the quick overview.
The quick overview was that my brother allowed me to run his portfolio when I was 12 in the early 1960s, and I drove it into the ground. And I just love stocks and bonds, and so I knew I couldn't become a broker. So I decided to become a securities lawyer.
Okay.
And when I was in the Army, I was stationed here in Washington, D.C., and I got to know the SEC by doing interviews. I was in military intelligence, which is to intelligence as military music is to music. And
right.
For a while, I was doing background investigations for security clearances, and I would interview people at the SEC. And there was a distinct and material difference between the quality of the people at the SEC and other federal agencies.
What was the difference?
First of all, they were there. Okay. In other words, they showed up for work. They were there early, stayed late. There was a vim and vigor. They had a cause. They were there to protect investors. Their enthusiasm was infectious, and you wanted to join them. So when I went to law school at the University of Wisconsin, I was the clerk to the Wisconsin Blue Sky Commissioner, summer clerk, and it worked so that I was able to do it during school year as well. And Jeff Bartel was the commissioner. He offered me, he was a wonderful guy, he still is a wonderful person. I got a job offer from him and went to the commission instead.
Okay.
And so it was the idea of seeing the commission from a completely different position, coming in as an Army investigator and doing interviews that convinced me that the SEC was not just the place, it was the only place I wanted to go.
Hmm. Tell me about coming down and interviewing. What job did you interview for?
That's an interesting question. My whole thought, because we didn't have any money, was to just go from Madison, Wisconsin to Chicago, which was the regional office. And my wife looked at me and said, if we're going to do this, you're going to do this. And so I came to Washington and interviewed with Market Reg, Enforcement, General Counsel's Office, and Corp Fin. And we did this in a two and a half day period. Also SIPC, because SIPC was, I didn't understand SIPC at the time and didn't know what SIPC did. So I interviewed there too. The amazing thing was that each one of these divisions had, at that time, had a different kind of interview. The General Counsel's Office, you actually had to take a written test, which I found fascinating because I don't know whether I passed it or not, but I did get an offer. The biggest point of the interview process was I was interviewed by Dick Rowe, and at that time the division was on North Capitol Street, and Dick Rowe's office was right next to Alan Levinson, who was the director of the division. Dick Rowe was a Marine. I was an Army person. I didn't quite know that I would, shall we say, be liked by a Marine. But the fact of the matter is, we started talking about history, and he was a history major. I was a history major. He looked at me, and he said, just hold it for a second, and he went through a door, and I didn't know where that door led, but it led to Alan Levinson, who was probably one of the greatest division directors you'll ever see, bless his soul. And he came back and he said, well, we just got our budget today, and I'm in a position to offer you a job as an examiner in the Division of Corporation Finance. Now, there is a thing in life called luck, and on that day, unlike the day I was drafted into the United States Army, on that day I was really lucky. I was lucky at a number of different levels, not the least of which was a Marine was hiring an Army person.
So you went to, you interviewed at all these other places too. Did you get the choice and basically say, well, I want to go with Corp Fin?
I love all the other divisions. I'm not going to say anything about the other divisions for whom and with whom I have a great deal of respect. But given the experience that I had at Wisconsin for the Wisconsin Commission, Securities Commission, Blue Sky Commission, Corp Fin was number one on the list for me.
Okay. So disclosure was the kind of thing you were going to get into.
It was where I wanted to be.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about that office and moving in, meeting the people, and sort of getting your bearings, figuring out how you were going to work.
It's fascinating. See, I'm one of the few people that you're probably going to interview who started out at the lowest level in the Division of Corporation Finance and left at the highest level. Hmm. I started out as an examiner in branch number 2 of the Division of Corporation Finance on January 20th, 1975. We had no training. You were given a pile of paper about 2 feet tall and told to read this. At that time, there were 3 books for Accounting Principles Board, APB, announcements. You had to buy them yourself if you wanted to learn about accounting. They were about $17.50, but who's counting? The fact of the matter is, that was what was available, okay, as an examiner. And I was in an office, and one of the major things about Corp Fin at that time was that there was no space. Now, that's a disadvantage. The advantage was you were put together with another person, okay, which was sometimes not a good thing if you were giving comments on one particular matter and the other person was giving comments. I mean, you could, in essence, have material non-public information going back and forth. But the person that I was the roommate with was a financial analyst by the name of Steve Wall.
How do you spell the name?
W-A-L-L.
Okay, sure.
Steve Wall had been in the Army as well. He was a Vietnam veteran. And he taught me everything I knew about financial analysis. At that time, the division was in 3 different professions, analyst, lawyer, and accountant. And at that time, there was no training. The training was really by osmosis. The training was what you picked up. And I, again, got lucky with Steve Wall. We had a branch chief by the name of Vassal Simmons, and in the branch were 2 people, Ed Colson and myself. Ed Colson was an accountant. I was a lawyer. Let's put it this way. Bill Simmons didn't give either one of us an outstanding rating because he had to write us up if he was going to give us an outstanding rating. In other words, if you got the second best rating, all he had to do was check a box.
Yeah.
If you got an outstanding rating, he had to write you up. I became the director of the Division of Corporation Finance, and Ed Colson became the chief accountant of the commission. In his office, he had these 2 people. Neither one of us ever got an outstanding rating. I was an examiner for 11 months, and quite frankly, at that time, and this was something, when I became a division director, there were lots of things that I had learned as an examiner, okay? One of the things that was done was you started your review on things that were not reviewed right now. In other words, I reviewed a Form 4, which is not reviewed by the division right now. The first registration statement I reviewed was an S-8. The first real registration statement I reviewed was an S-9, which doesn't exist anymore. It really is an investment-grade debt. And one of the most important points about this was that while you were given a little bit of lead time in terms of crawling before you could walk, responsibility was pushed down to you very quickly, very quickly. And I was a first lieutenant. I was a platoon commander during Vietnam, and I can tell you that this was the kind of responsibility that young people loved to get. I mean, you either swam or you sunk with respect to this.
Did you ever see anybody sink?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. There were.
Because I always talk to the people who swam. I never get to the people who
but
sunk.
But you have to understand, I, as a division director, tried to make sure that everybody survived. Mm. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's what's really important, given my background before coming to the staff, was that the division is a family. It's a team. You're only as good as the people who are not as swift as everybody else, not as capable as everybody else, but you're not going to win unless they all go over the finish line. And I, as an examiner, saw different performance rates and that sort of thing among and between people, but the idea of collegiality, the idea of just everybody's in this together, okay, and you're going to help each other, was something that really made me a better supervisor once I got to be a supervisor. Not to mention, given the fact that operations was the heart of the division, and it still is the heart of the division, I was very lean on supervisory staff when I got to be a supervisor. I spent the money on more people in operations, giving them more money, because money was not something that was, shall we say, prevalent at the time, and made sure that operations was, I used to say, you had to feed operations in order for the division to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't have a deputy director. I didn't have very many. It's fascinating now. There are two deputy directors. Everybody's got a special counsel at the head of the division. I didn't have any of that, nor did I want any of that.
It goes along with giving people the power to do their work.
It really does. Okay, pushing responsibility down. Okay, and trusting. And this is a really important thing. People were trusted. And that actually is important, another important lesson when I became a supervisor, because there were appeals of decisions. And this is not a blind trust. I mean, you have to know the people that you're working with. And while I was just in operations for less than a year, okay, as an examiner before... Mm-hmm. I went to disclosure policy, you knew who the people were and you knew what kind of people they were. I'll give you an example. There was a money center bank in my branch. This was before industry specialization. I mean, I did an insurance company. I did a money center bank. I did a company like Procter & Gamble. There was no rhyme or reason.
No specialization.
Okay, to any of this. One of the things I helped do when I got to be a supervisor was industry specialization. But after industry specialization occurred, there was an AD, his name was Dick Tao, and when I was in the branch, this particular money center bank, their answer to every comment was, it's not material. Okay? So, you know, is this a problem? No, it's not material. I was sitting in my office. I had an open door policy. It's a very important point to have an open door policy as a supervisor. And that doesn't mean the door is necessarily open. It means that you're always welcome to come in.
Right.
And Dick Tao came into my office along about 6:30, 7 o'clock. One of the biggest things I learned was to be there early for the accountants and to be there late for the lawyers and the analysts. And Dick said, we got this problem with this money center bank. And I said, what's the comment? And he said, well, we asked him about their exposure to Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina. And Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina was the biggest issue at the time. Okay, it was huge, all right, for money center banks. And the reviews for banks were focused on these things. The reviews for savings and loans focused on other things. And I looked at Dick and I said, well, I mean, they used to be in my branch when I was an examiner. Obviously, they gave you the answer, it's not material. And Dick looked at me and he said, no, they didn't say it's not material. They started talking about X, Y, and Z, okay, which are not germane to my point here. I knew the moment that Dick said that the answer was different than what was there, that there was an issue there. Turned out that this particular money center bank had a huge exposure to Brazil. And quite frankly, Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina inundated the staff with issues for a long time because I got to know the Federal Reserve Board, Michael C. Bradfield, the general counsel of the Federal Reserve Board, Burl Sprinkle, who was the head of the Council of Economic Advisors. The SEC had been at the forefront of things like Guide 3 becoming a disclosure for banks.
Guide 3?
Guide 3 was a guide for in the preparation of registration statements and periodic reports, and it's disclosure for banks, specialized disclosure for banks.
Okay.
That was Charlie Ogilvy, but that's a different story. This story was that once the commission got involved in Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina, I was sort of the point person for the staff as both deputy director when I got in charge of operations and as director to coordinate with these other agencies. And what was fascinating about this was that the Federal Reserve was interested in safety and soundness, the SEC was interested in investor protection, and you used to have these wonderful civilized debates about what was more important, safety and soundness or investor protection, and you're having the same sort of debate today. And whether it's Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina that put a hole in money center banks' balance sheets or subprime mortgages, the same concept, the same issue is there today. So like Yogi Berra, it's deja vu all over again.
Yeah.
The same sort of issues were there with respect to savings and loans, because savings and loans at that time were big. They still were there.
Right.
And this was in the early 1980s. There was one particular savings and loan that the commission had been focused on, both in terms of enforcement and in terms of CorpFin. And there used to be very close coordination between CorpFin and enforcement. When I was a director, I was the biggest client of the Division of Enforcement. It's a very little known fact, but you have to actually convince enforcement to take a case. Okay, so going in and talking to them about Section 5, going in and talking to them about a technical matter, that's not the only thing they want to hear. They want to hear fraud. They want to hear stuff that they can actually make hay about. Financial Corporation of America was under a person by the name of Charlie Knapp, who was taking it to a huge level. It was a $33 billion savings and loan in the early 1980s. He was acquiring companies. He was doing things with respect to accounting that people found problematic. Okay,
and he was one of these pioneers in savings and loans, moving them out, I guess,
yeah,
away from their old
pioneers,
stodgy underpinnings.
Yeah. The image that I would give you, we had a commission meeting once on savings and loans, on FCA in particular, and the image that I would give you was from John Shadd, who gave, and this is sort of a sexist image, but it was very poignant. He said, savings and loans are like a chorus line of old ladies trying to kick up their legs. The fact of the matter is, Charlie Knapp was not just a pioneer. He was at the forefront of doing things in too aggressive a fashion.
Okay.
And the point that I have for you is that when we, the division, reviewed FCA, Financial Corporation of America's periodic reports, there was a thing that came up with respect to Charlie Knapp, and it was something that dealt with an early form of derivative called a dollar reverse repurchase, a dollar roll. I'm not going to get into the technics of it, but the basic point about this was that it allowed Charlie Knapp to bet on interest rates. And he bet on interest rates every quarter. He was wrong every quarter. And he would double up on his bet. Now, this is not unheard of in terms of traders and that sort of thing. But you got to understand, Charlie Knapp was a government-insured entity. Okay, FISLIC, okay, was still in existence at the time. And the United States Congress had just increased the insurance for savings and loans from $50,000 to $100,000. And they allowed, in essence, a person to have multiple accounts instead of just one account. So my name is John Huber. I could have it as J. Huber, John Huber, John James Huber. That's three accounts, okay? And that doesn't even include my wife, my children, my family, or if I wanted to include Ken Doerr, okay? Right. The fact of the matter is this was known as hot money, and hot money was moving very fast through the system, and FCA had a lot of hot money. And he had to perform. So dollar rolls were not something that anybody knew about, and I love accounting. I practice more accounting than my license allows, and I learned to love accounting in the Division of Corporation Finance. And the fact is, nobody knew anything about dollar rolls. So
nobody in the SEC.
Nobody in the SEC mm-hmm. had a handle on it. There was very close coordination between CorpFin and the Office of the Chief Accountant of the Commission. And I got to know a PAF, professional accounting fellow, by the name of Michael McLaughlin. Michael's dead. But he had come from KPMG, and he had an idea of what these were, okay, and how they worked. Mm-hmm. And he and I went to talk to the SNL committee of the AICPA. And they had heard about these things, but it would take them 6 months to figure out and have a position. And I looked at them and I said, I have less than 6 weeks. Okay. So the fact of the matter was and is, and this is my real point with respect to this, the commission decided to, because this was a huge kind of thing, I mean, Charlie Knapp was betting one-third of his balance sheet on these things, and he was losing. Okay, and he was going to have a cataclysmic kind of event. I talked to the people at the Federal Home Loan Bank Board and FISLIC. For a $33 billion company, you had $7 billion worth of FISLIC insurance. So you had a small shortfall from a depositor standpoint. That, from an MD&A standpoint, is a known uncertainty for the United States government. Okay. And so we had a number of meetings with FCA. They did not agree that their accounting needed to be corrected. And I had to send them to enforcement. And the biggest point about this story with respect to coordination between CorpFin and enforcement was John Fetters was the director at the time. I called him and I said, I'm going to need you on FCA. That same day, he had a group of over a dozen lawyers call FCA. Hmm. A dozen enforcement lawyers on a call is something that is shock and awe of the first order. And so the fact of the matter is, as it turned out, I mean, FCA is no more, was no more, and it was because of this particular point. Now,
what did they do? How did FCA respond to this? 12 lawyers.
Eventually, they acknowledged that they were taking a loss. I had to go and testify in front of Congress. I testified almost 24 times, but on this one, I was trying to explain to them what a dollar reverse repurchase was, and the only way that I could do it was to tell congressmen and women that a rolling loan gathers no loss. And the fact of the matter is, that's what was happening. He was rolling these loans and never incurring a loss, even though he had a huge inchoate loss, mm-hmm. okay, mm-hmm. that jeopardized his solvency, but also jeopardized FISLIC. And so eventually Charlie Knapp lost his job. But there were over a million shares, and this is in the early 1980s, so a million shares traded of FCA every day were being traded, and just like with respect to Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina for money center banks, and there used to be 12,000 banks when I was on staff, this was a huge issue in terms of investor protection. And a large debate in terms of, gee, does the commission know what it's doing with respect to the accounting for these things when you're taking out a savings and loan in this regard? And my answer back to regulators from other agencies was a very simple answer, which is the SEC is supposed to protect investors. We don't protect deposits. After FCA, there were 56, if memory serves me correctly, 56 savings and loan holding companies. See, the SEC didn't regulate the savings and loan. They regulated the savings and loan, the holding company that was publicly traded, just like for bank holding companies, the SEC regulates holding companies. And so, and this was something I did of my own initiative. And see, the commission used to support initiative, okay? In other words, if you were a bright person, you were A, trusted by the commission, and B, you thought, the term today is thinking outside the box, but I mean, you had a mission, and the mission was to protect investors, and you were going to protect investors. And the fact of the matter is, I ordered, and I had the ability to do it, I was the director, I ordered all of the other savings and loan holding companies to be reviewed for the same kinds of things. In other words, Wall Street was selling these early forms of derivatives as interest rate hedges, what would now be called hedges, to these financial institutions, and they really didn't understand what they were buying. They didn't understand how they worked. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of them were doing it.
What were the derivatives we're talking about now?
Dollar rolls.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
And there were different forms of those, okay? But
gotcha.
The review of all of the savings loan holding companies resulted in five or six being identified as having these problems. So the commission, in essence, had an early warning system with respect to changing these sorts of practices. And at that time, that was sufficient to cause other people, like the AICPA and other people, to start to accelerate to think what was going on. Ironically, I had left the commission in 1986, and Linda Quinn became my successor, and I was in California one time, which I was out working for a client, and Linda tracked me down in my hotel room in California in the late 1980s, and she said, when you did that review after FCA, did you review Lincoln Savings and Loan? And I said, well, if it was a savings and loan, it would have been reviewed because I ordered all of them to be reviewed. Mm-hmm. And this is when the entire thing about what the commission was doing with Lincoln Savings and Loan was coming up. And Linda checked, and Lincoln Savings and Loan wasn't in the financial branch. It was in the real estate branch, and they found it, and it had been reviewed for these things, and they had found issues with respect to it. So those were two of the biggest issues, Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina, and savings loan, and they permeated the 1980s in terms of issues, and they're very relevant today. Same basic questions with respect to accounting, same basic questions with respect to new products, same basic questions with respect to the debate between safety and soundness in terms of one side and investor protection with respect to the other. And I can tell you that the SEC protects investors. The other things with respect to operations really were things like IPOs, initial public offerings.
Right.
You want me to get it?
Let's talk a little bit about one of the things that sort of seems like it must bracket your time there is the IPOs and the tender offers, especially the tender offers. And I know that sort of gets ginned up early. The Williams Act is back there, and people start taking advantage of it in the mid-70s. Tell me a little bit about how that sort of rose onto the over the horizon while you were in Corp Fin?
The Williams Act was enacted by Congress in 1968 and amended in 1970. I came to the commission in 1975.
Right.
The division, the SEC had essentially written the Williams Act for Congress. That was at a time when there was great coordination between Congress and the SEC, and great respect, incidentally, for the SEC from Congress. So the SEC was viewed as the expert agency, so if you had an issue, the issue was one in which the SEC was consulted and deferred to. Okay, so when you've got lots of people like this, but the people like Jimmy Ling in the late 1960s were taking over lots of companies, things like dirty pooling with respect to stock-for-stock acquisitions. Acquisitions became hot in the late 1960s. This really follows the market going down and real values being there.
Right.
Go back to my
right.
point about driving my brother's portfolio into the ground. The fact is that there were temporary rules adopted by the commission. And when I was in operations for about a year, and a special project came up for disclosure policy. And disclosure policy was an office headed up by Mickey Beach was the associate director, and Roland Cook was the chief of the Office of Disclosure Policy. And the special project was on going private transactions, which Al Sommer has, as a commissioner, had given a big speech about at, I think, Notre Dame. So this project was really strange from a division standpoint because enforcement was looking at over two dozen going private transactions. In the late 1970s, a lot of companies that had gone public in the period of time in the early 1970s were going private afterward. They're doing the same thing again because market prices have gone down. And so enforcement took all the really hot cases and gave Corp Fin, because the commission wanted all of these cases to be looked at, a number of them, and I became a hearing officer for one of these in 1976.
What was involved in being a hearing officer?
It was just like being an enforcement lawyer, okay? The fact of the matter was, this was ATO for American LaFrance. American LaFrance makes fire engines.
Mm-hmm.
ATO had, in essence, done an IPO of American LaFrance, 10%, and within 18 months took it private.
Who was ATO?
ATO was a company that was run from Ohio, run by a guy named Harry Figge.
Hmm.
And I did the investigation. And quite frankly, the lawyer for ATO for the IPO was Al Sommer, who was then sitting as a commissioner at the SEC. And he had just given this speech about going private. So, I mean, it's a very small world.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact of the matter was I had this case, and I asked Mr. Figge to come in, and I deposed Mr. Figge. I had a court reporter there and myself. Mr. Figge came in with eight lawyers. Eight. This is lean and mean is the commission staff. Okay, I was right out of law school. He had almost an entire law firm with him. And I'm asking him questions, and he would, you know, after my name is Harry Figge and his address, he literally looked at another lawyer for an answer on each one of the questions. Now, I was in the Army, and I did background investigations for security clearances. I know how to ask questions, and I know how questions are supposed to be answered. But the idea of a man looking to his counsel for each one of these, okay, I looked at Mr. Figge, and I said, we're not going to go any further. You're going to go out into the hallway, and you're going to talk to these lawyers, and then you're going to come in, and you're going to answer these questions.
Mm.
Or else this is over,
okay?
He did that, okay? I didn't consult with anybody, okay? The fact of the matter was, I was convinced even before Harry Figge came in the room that there was no case here, because the disclosure in the S-1, the IPO prospectus, had said, we're selling 10% of American LaFrance, and we may at any time take it back. And the disclosure had been written by Al Sommer. And the disclosure was beautiful disclosure, and there was no case. Mr. Figge didn't have anything to worry about. All he had to do was talk about the disclosure. Ironically, neither Mr. Figge nor eight of his lawyers focused my attention on that. That was something I did. Mm-hmm. And so the impartiality of the staff, in other words, the staff may see that there's a problem with respect to something, but the beauty of the staff of the commission is that they actually do look at something in an impartial fashion, and they are not hell-bent on trying to get something that isn't right.
There weren't people in enforcement who were predisposed to try to find something wrong with some of these going private transactions.
I have no idea about enforcement. I can only say that the people that I was dealing with, okay, were not predisposed to do any of that. And the fact of the matter is, it went to the idea of not being afraid to try new things, and also not being afraid to say there is no case here. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, during the course of that, I got involved in going private transactions, and I read there was a man by the name of Mr. Silver, and I'll never forget the correspondence from Mr. Silver to the SEC. And he said, you know, I bought 24 companies in the early 1970s. They've all gone private. They've all done extremely well after they went private, and I lost the opportunity to have this. And at the same time, there was a case going up to the Supreme Court, Santa Fe v. Green, where the Supreme Court was asked whether, in essence, it was a 10b-5 problem to go private. And the Supreme Court said, I think in footnote 14, well, guess what? If there's disclosure, there's not a problem under 10b-5, and there's not substantive regulation under 10b-5. And that was a huge debate in the case law as to whether or not 10b-5 had substantive disclosure. If you looked at 13e of the 34 Act, you would see that there is an argument that there is a thing called substantive fraud as opposed to disclosure-based fraud. And when I got to write rules, and I wrote rules for 6-7 years, I actually proposed a rule on substantive fraud, which actually would have, in essence, turned Santa Fe v. Green on its head. The commission did not adopt the rule. What it did adopt was a very big disclosure-based rule called 13E3. And 13E3 did some remarkable things. Taking tax courses. I was taking tax courses at the time of 13E3, and it was during my the time when I was writing rules like a tax person would write rules. If you look at the exemptions, they're all based on tax. Okay, you have a like-kind exchange exemption. You have, all sorts of the entire rule is like the Internal Revenue Code in terms of its complexity, in terms of its disclosure. But the critical point was that it covered all sorts of going private transactions. And it's not been amended since 1979. One of the things that really got me about all the rules that I wrote was that, you know, I didn't expect any of these things to last more than 5 years. 14E3, which is insider trading in the context of a tender offer, and 13E3 have not been amended at all. Hmm. The other ones were. The first rule that I wrote was Schedule 14D1, which is the predecessor to Schedule TO, and that was about tender offers. In other words, when I got after this little sojourn on going private transactions, I was asked to join the Office of Disclosure Policy. And the biggest project at that time for disclosure policy was not independent directors, although that was a huge project, and it was not projections, although that was a big project. Those projects were in the office. There were two people, John Granda and myself. John Granda got beneficial ownership, and I got the tender offer rules. Again, luck in life is actually important, but you got to be prepared for luck. Mm. I didn't know diddly about tender offers. Nothing. Hmm. Okay? Not to mention, once I started looking at this, they're contract-based.
Are we looking at the real early 80s here?
We're looking at the late 70s.
Late 70s, okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tender offers are contract-driven, believe it or not. A tender offer is not an offer. It's a solicitation of tenders to the bidder, okay, which if you tender your securities, the bidder under certain terms will accept. Okay. I didn't get a good grade in contracts, so I had to become a specialist in contracts as well as in tender offers. And for 3 years, I did tender offers. And one of the major things about this was to, once you developed a specialty in something, and I became the specialist in the Williams Act. Okay, John Granted and I went, he was one of the people that went to Georgetown at night. Okay, and we used to drive, he and his wife lived close to our house, and we used to go back and forth to work, okay, after class, and we talked about the Williams Act, and we coordinated, and there was a great deal of overlap between things like instruction C of 13D and what instruction C is now under Schedule TO, and that's not through a fluke. We worked together hand in glove, and we trusted each other, and we worked in a way that was seamless in terms of getting something done. The fact of the matter is, I became a specialist in tender offers. And it was well known in the commission that I was. And so there was an enforcement case that came up. And that enforcement case was the Sun Oil Company buying over a third of a company called Becton Dickinson. Mm-hmm. Becton and the case was a huge case because at that time there was no definition of the term tender offer. Case law was not defined. The fact of the matter was that you looked at what happened and in one afternoon Sun bought controlling interest in Becton Dickinson. Was that a tender offer? I was asked to help Ted Sondy on the case. I was a young attorney. I mean, Ted Sondy was an associate director in enforcement. I was, in essence, put to enforcement to help him because enforcement, with all due respect to the people in enforcement, were not familiar with the area. That's not to say they weren't smart. That's not to say they didn't know what they were doing.
Right.
It's to say that this was a very technical area and they needed technical help. That was me. Not to mention I had read everything there was. Okay. And there was a law reviewer. Herb Einhorn was a prolific writer. He actually specialized in proxy contests. And proxy contests were the thing of the 1960s. Tender offers were the thing of the 1970s and 80s. We can talk about the difference between them, but the fact of the matter was Marty Lipton and Wachtell Lipton was counsel to Sun, had written a law review article about Herb Einhorn's first book, and Marty is a great writer. Okay, I read everything that Marty Lipton wrote. And in this law review article, it was just a book review. Okay, he, Marty Lipton, described the fact pattern that was Becton Dickinson, and at the very end of this, he put, "If ever there was a tender offer, this is it." Okay, well, that was the first footnote in the complaint that the SEC filed against Sun. Citing Marty Lipton against Marty Lipton.
That book review,
okay? And for that find, okay, I, as what you would call a third year, okay, if you were in private practice, I was a third year. I was invited, by enforcement to sign the complaint. Now, there's competition among divisions at the SEC. Let's be very realistic, okay? I'm a Corp Fin person, okay? The fact of the matter is that competition is one in which it at that time was a very healthy kind of competition. enforcement always thought that Corp Fin would give away the store. I was, in essence, the biggest client of the Division of Enforcement. As I said before, I didn't give away the store. The question was balancing investor protection with capital formation, and enforcement being prosecutors are much more prone to investor protection than capital formation. Right. For what it's worth, I haven't changed my philosophy since I left the commission, okay? I'm still the same person that I was in 1986, okay? But to be asked to sign a complaint in the premier unconventional tender offer case was the greatest compliment that enforcement ever gave me. And quite frankly, the commission won the case, and the acquisition company was LHIW. Nobody could ever figure out whether it meant let's hope it works or Lipton hopes it works. But the fact of the matter is, being creative on the name of an acquisition company is a pretty good indicator that you are being too cute by half. Now, unconventional tender offers were something that permeated this area, okay, and it wasn't until 1980 that the commission proposed a definition of the term tender offer. I wrote that release. There were two people working on unconventional tender offers at the time, a fellow by the name of Stephen P. Lamb, who's a vice chancellor in Delaware right now, and myself. He did legislation. I did rules. He wrote what I called the Lamb Act, which went up to Congress and never was acted on. And I wrote the proposed definition of the term tender offer, and it was going to be up on the commission calendar for adoption in November of 1980. There was an election, if you'll recall. I went up to the chairman's office and talked to Harold Williams about getting it calendared because we still had problems with respect to tender offers. And Harold Williams said, John, there was an election. We're not going to do it. That rule is still proposed for comment. It's been proposed for comment for almost 30 years. Never been withdrawn, okay? But the rest of the rules on tender offers got adopted, all of them, okay? And that's Regulation 14D, Regulation 14E. The fact of the matter is, go back to the trust point. The commission trusted the staff. I mean, I wrote in one release, I wrote an inquiry about shouldn't you have a recommendation by the target company, the subject company is the technical term for target company. And the reason for that was I found a 10b-5 case where a person had asked a company, is this a good time to sell the stock? And the company didn't say anything. Silence. And the person didn't sell. Within short order, there was a merger, which had been talked about at the time. And the holding of the court case with respect to a merger was there was no 10b-5 violation because under blue chip stamps, the person had not sold. And therefore, there was no 10b-5 problem. Well, the investment decision in a tender offer is not like the investment decision in 10b-5. The investment decision in a tender offer is to tender to this or another bidder to sell into the marketplace or hold. And so 14E2 and Schedule 14D9 were written in response to that case. And they were written in a very simple way, okay, on a specific inquiry asking people, what do you think about having a recommendation rule? Okay? After that, the entire thing came in, and 14D9 has never been changed since it was adopted in the early 1980s.
Now, there was a committee on tender offers, early 80s.
That was after all of my tender offer work.
Okay.
And that was when Linda was the associate director, legal, and I was the director. And that was the committee that was formed that gave you the offer to all rule and unlimited proration throughout. I can get to that in a minute. But there's one rule I want to give you before that. And that is 14E3. There was a case that was going to the Supreme Court about a printer. It was the printer case. And he had called his broker 50 times, and he was literally reading tender offer materials at the printer and buying the stock. He was front-running the stock.
Chiarella case.
Yes, Vincent T. Chiarella. Okay, I went to the hearing to see Mr. Chiarella. He was, his lawyer said he was very poor, but he was very well dressed, and he was going to the Supreme Court. Okay, he won. The fact of the matter was, 14E3 was in the works before Mr. Chiarella even went to the district court. And that was a rule that Dick Rowe, whenever I went to a meeting with Dick Rowe, usually I was the person who came out of the room and I had the assignment, okay? And Dick Rowe was reading Forbes, and there was a big article in Forbes about how stock prices were going up before a tender offer commenced. He looked at me and he said, write a rule. Okay? That was about, I mean, go back to the point that he was a Marine and I was from the Army. Okay?
Yeah.
I didn't really question anything other than, okay, when do you want it? And the rule that he got was 14E3, which was insider trading in the context of a tender offer. The rule got adopted. Again, the commission was trusting the staff. The rule went up to the Supreme Court twice on validity. And see, the most important thing about it, I wrote rules for a long time. I'm one of the few people you know who actually has read the Administrative Procedures Act. If you can't win on the merits, you test a rule by its validity. Okay, go back to the point about Charles Cox did all of these economic studies on my tender offer rules, okay? Well, you're going to have a Brandeisian laboratory kind of basis for every rule, and you're going to adopt every rule under every section you possibly can, because if it's invalidated under that section, well, we got that section, okay? The fact of the matter is, 14E3 nailed people real good, okay, in terms of insider trading in the context of a tender offer. Enforcement loved the rule, okay? And the fact is, it went up a couple of times, and the issue was validity. And each time, the courts validated the rule, and each time I worked with the general counsel's office to make sure that the general counsel's office were cognizant of the fact that they had to defend the faith with respect to these rules. Now, in other words, it was their job to go to court to defend the rule, but
right.
I worked with them to make sure that my rule, 14E3, didn't get invalidated. It's important, if it was one of my rules, I took a personal interest. As a rule writer, that's what you do. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And
felt a proprietary interest on these things.
Definitely. I mean, the tender offer study where Warren Buffett was on was one where you had problems with proration pools. The way the statute worked was that if you were devious, and this wasn't something that was there in the late 70s or early 80s, but by the mid 80s. People were doing proration pools in which, in essence, you could pay people different consideration. And so the upshot of the study was, in essence, to have a predicate for the commission to take action against proration pools. And the concept of, 14D7 of the statute had always been the best price offered to all kind of concept. But it became a rule, 14D10, and it was a rule that actually was needed at the time in order to respond. And once unlimited proration came through, okay, you never had another proration pool problem again. So it was a question really of timing, okay? The commission used to have the time to study something and get something that was an answer to something. Today, the commission doesn't have very much time at all. In other words, instantaneous responses are what is necessary. The rulemaking that I worked on for over 3 years on integration was one in which I used to have what I call train schedules. After tender offers, I went to the general counsel's office to get a promotion, really, to get it from a GS-14 to a GS-15, but also there was a Supreme Court decision on the first-generation state takeover statutes that were coming in. Mm-hmm. And it was the Hunt Brothers case that was going up to the Supreme Court. And I wanted to be on that case. And so I went to Ralph Farrar was the general counsel, mm-hmm. and I got into the counseling group, which is, I was the special counsel to the associate general counsel counseling group. And I was on that brief, and the fact of the matter was, I got to meet the Hunt brothers. The Hunt brothers were going after the state of Idaho, which had, in essence, asserted their statute against the Hunt brothers with respect to a tender offer that the Hunt brothers had done. It was ironic that the SEC was on the side of the Hunt brothers, but the SEC wanted to get these statutes invalidated because they were, in essence, stopping tender offers.
Right.
The fact is, again, we had a Supreme Court hearing that I went to, and there was a lady from the New York Attorney General's office who was apoplectic that she had been called down to Texas for this case. She didn't think that that was right. All of us from the SEC, you know, kept saying, gee, why doesn't the court just get to the real action here? The real case is a constitutional case with respect to preemption, okay? Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter was the Supreme Court was looking for a procedural case to make the point that people like the person from New York should not have to go down to Texas. The Supreme Court never got to the merits, okay? Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter was, all that preparation was for naught, but after that case, a rule called 14 D2B was adopted by the commission at my recommendation, and if you look at the release that adopted 14 D2B, it had the tangential effect of preempting 38 state takeover statutes. So there is a relationship between case law and rulemaking. And the commission at that time was very savvy about watching how cases developed, watching how tender offer practice developed, watching how all that developed.
How did you divide up the work on this rulemaking? I mean, you must have had people that you were working with to create these things.
I was in the general counsel's office. It was I think a Friday afternoon, and Mike Connell and Ed Green came to my office. Now, when you're a special counsel and an associate director and a director from a different division come to your office, it was a very interesting occasion. I had just gotten the Manny Cohen Award as an outstanding young attorney for the tender offer work, and they wanted me to come back to disclosure policy to run integration. Now, to his credit, Ed Green was the person who was the director that really got integration moving, okay? Now, what does that mean? What that means is there was the Milton Cohen article in the 1960s that basically said the 33 and the 34 Act didn't work well together, they didn't play well together as children, 34 Act should have been adopted before the 33 Act. The fact of the matter is something's got to be done. That's nice, but that was just an article, okay? Louis Loss, bless his heart, who was an assistant general counsel, went to Harvard and started the Loss Code, which was a humongous revision of the federal securities law, soup to nuts. And I was not privy to those conversations, but the fact of the matter was and is that the commission really always wanted to administer its own federal securities laws rather than to have Congress change them. And if you want to see some examples of that, go read, you know, Sarbanes-Oxley and what Congress is doing today. Mm-hmm. I was always taught as a young attorney that you never let the Congress get a hold of the federal securities laws. Mm-hmm. Integration is the high watermark of the commission doing what Congress couldn't do. or wouldn't do. And the fact is, the work that we did was preceded by another study by Mickey Beach, who did a study on integration. And it was done also by the adoption of a new form called S16. S16 was the first short form registration statement that used incorporation by reference. And incorporation by reference is the grease that makes integration move. The fact of the matter was, nobody was using S16, nobody. And if you did the homework, you would find out that it was because investment bankers did not want to have a 12-page prospectus to sell something. They wanted to have something to sell. Okay, so therefore, the concept of short-form registration was not being used at all.
People didn't trust the short form. I mean, it was too different, I guess.
It was too different because you used to have these big registration statements, and people said, "Well, it's all in there." Okay.
Right.
So
the heavier it was, the better, I guess.
Let's put it this way: not necessarily heavier, but the more that an investment banker could write to tell his or her story, the better.
Okay.
And it's about selling. Okay. And so the idea of how to blend, and this is a very important point with respect to integration, how to, in essence, do what Milton Cohen wanted, how to make S16 work, how to, in essence, modernize the federal securities laws, was my job as chief of the Office of Disclosure Policy. I had 8 people total.
Okay.
We did the whole thing soup to nuts, okay, in a 3-year period. And I used to have train schedules. They were a schedule, they were on the wall, and if you had, like Linda Quinn had SK. Okay, Linda Quinn was working in my office at that time. And she would have a train schedule, and that train schedule basically had, this was done in the kind of way that was team-oriented and extremely cooperative, because all of these moving pieces had to fit together, okay? When the 2005 revisions came in, it was one release of several hundred pages. It was proposed once, okay? What we did in integration was there were multiple releases. They came off like a conveyor belt because your train schedule would have this being done at this time with this comment period, and all of them had to mesh because at the very end, you were going to be done with integration, okay? So the idea of doing SK first, the idea of doing the form second, the idea of understanding that you had to do Regulation C with respect to all the procedural rules and how that fit into this, everybody had a task.
Hmm.
Everybody had something that they had to do, okay? But they all had to do it on time, and they had to cooperate, and they had to coordinate with each other. And one of the biggest things that I did, okay, was to involve operations, because nobody was more cognizant of what was happening in the world at that time than the people who were reviewing filings. And things like, go back to the bank holding company point, banks used to come to market in a herd. And this industry specialization had begun, and so Dick Tao was now the assistant director in terms of banks, and there was no requirement that you had to review, you know, one company every 3 years like you do under Sarbanes-Oxley now. So when somebody came in with respect to the first registration statement, they would be selected for review. The next 3 or 4 would be selected for review, but the next 20 would not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so you had these companies coming. Medium-term notes was a brand new kind of security at that time, and so lots of companies were coming to market. The staff was becoming a bottleneck with respect to capital formation. Go back
right
to my point about the role of the SEC was investor protection and capital formation. It's actually written in the 33 Act. Okay, I keep pointing that out to enforcement, that capital formation is in the statute. Okay, but the fact of the matter is, it's a huge point that the staff was becoming a bottleneck. And there used to be a rule, an informal rule, called the 48-hour rule, that you had to be on file for 48 hours before you could be declared effective. So at the same time, okay, that the market was starting to perk up, okay, and it wasn't perking up for equity. I mean, from 1975 to 1983, equity was still really dead. But it was perking up for debt after 1980-81, when interest rates all of a sudden went down from, you know, a prime rate of 19% to a very low prime rate. And in those years, you would have like 60 to 70 changes in the prime rate. So banks and financial institutions that needed capital would watch to see if the prime rate was changing. And once the prime rate changed in their favor, they would all rush in with a registration statement. And the staff was the bottleneck. So you had to do something with respect to this because, and this is the other point here, the euro market was growing. The euro market was taking away business from New York. Okay? In essence, the gold standard was still New York, but the euro market was coming in with faster, better, quicker execution with respect to trades. And they didn't really care about the niceties of disclosure as much as the SEC did. So something had to be done, okay? And there was a big meeting in Ed's office about what to do, and just like all the rest of these meetings, at the end of it, you know, the person that got the assignment to fix the problem was me, okay? Well, I mean, that was, I love that, okay? I just wanted more instruction than what I normally got, because this one was a really tough nut to crack. Because shelf registration had been around for a long time, but it had never been turbocharged. Shelf registration started in the 1960s with respect to a series of acquisitions by a really big company that were, in essence, all done in rapid fire order. So instead of having one big S4 for 50 different things, you could do one S4 for a series of acquisitions.
Okay, and then do them all in pieces.
And then do them all in pieces. Okay. The fact of the matter was, the theory was, if that worked for acquisitions, why couldn't that work for debt?
Right.
Okay? And if that worked for debt, why couldn't that work for equity? And if that worked for equity, why couldn't that work for anything? Okay? In other words, this is part and parcel of the commission staff thinking outside the box. There are lots of things where the commission staff reacted to something, but also lots of things where the commission staff went to the next level. Mm-hmm. In other words, things like Edgar, things like electronic filing. Okay? There was a project at the a patent office. Okay? Had been going on for years before the commission got into this. The staff was drowning in paper. We had these stupid little things on microfiche, okay, that literally, I mean, nobody could read.
Right.
The staff used to ask for filings, okay, copies of filings to be delivered by registrants, and who could never understand why that was the case. Well, because the staff couldn't read the microfiche, okay. So Edgar was, in essence, a way of the staff getting information, okay, so that they could read it. The tangential effect of Edgar was it took the commission from the late 20th century way into the 21st century, and it was the predicate for the commission looking super modern, okay, in 1984.
Right.
Okay, I'll get back to that in a minute, but in terms of shelf registration, the euro market was taking New York's lunch.
Did this idea that you could use the 60s model, this older form of self-registration, had that been discussed at this meeting that you talked about?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was discussed, but it was, you know, gee, can it work this way?
Right. So how do we get from there to where we want to be?
There were lots of different alternatives that were discussed. In other words, this wasn't... Nobody at that meeting had, quote, the answer. Okay? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there was a wonderful meeting. Everybody had... You have to understand, there were... I went to lots of meetings where there was a huge discussion, you know, lots of points of view, but at some point, somebody had to do something, okay? And you had to do it quick. And by our standards, quick is a whole lot longer than the commission standards today, and I do not envy yeah. the commission staff because they have to do things quicker, and quite frankly, they're more complex than they were when I was there. So... we went and did the shelf rule. The shelf rule was the apex of integration, okay, in terms of the theory. S4 for merger proxies was the apex in terms of getting the 33 and the 34 Act together. And S4 followed, okay, shelf registration. Okay. But shelf registration was proposed, I think, 4 times before it was adopted, okay. And there was a huge debate about shelf registration.
Proposed 4 times before. You had that sort of, I think it was a 1-year trial.
Yes, we had a pilot program.
Right.
We had lots of things, okay? It was proposed as Rule 462 Cap A, okay? That was an awkward term. We finally got to 415, and the common knowledge from the staff was it was called 415 because that's when the lawyer was called in order to do a deal the next morning, 4:15 p.m., okay, to actually get the deal done the next morning. Because that's how fast transactions were going, and it raised issues with respect to diligence. It raised issues with respect to the ordinary kinds of issues with respect to the congruity of Section 11, okay, liability with marketing and selling.
Right.
And see, the beauty of integration was that Rule 176 was there with respect to liability under Section 11, and 176 was already in process when the shelf rule was in process. And you had the capability of jiggering 176 so that it fit with what you were going to do under shelf registration. Mm-hmm. And so There were proposals, there was a trial period, there was a question as to whether or not it should be just restricted to S3 companies or should be allowed to be used by everybody. There were huge discussions on Wall Street with respect to the issue of whether this was a good idea or not. Okay, I'll give you an example. I was one of the hearing officers for the commission hearing on this, and you had the commissioners up on a dais, okay, in the hearing room, okay, and then you had the staff, and then you had a person testifying in front of the commission. And one day, this fellow's name was John Whitehead from Solomon Brothers. This is for the person from Liar's Poker, okay, and he was decrying the fact that the shelf rule didn't allow Solomon Brothers to do any due diligence, okay? And he said grass would grow on Wall Street and this was the most awful thing in the whole wide world. And I'm sitting there listening to this thinking that the shelf rule is now doomed, okay? This is one of the premier investment banking firms decrying the commission's action. I was also, I didn't have a deputy director, so I was in charge of operations, and Ann Wallace was a assistant director, and she came into the hearing room, and she said, we have a problem, and I said, you have a problem, I got a problem with Solomon Brothers, and she said, funny thing, okay, Solomon Brothers is the underwriter for a deal that was just filed this morning, and they want to go effective this afternoon. And there was this thing called the 48-hour rule that I alluded to before that you could not go effective quicker than 48 hours even if you were not going to be reviewed by the division. And I looked at Ann and I said, you tell whoever you're talking to that John Whitehead is saying he needs time with respect to doing due diligence on this filing. And you ask them if they've done their due diligence. Okay? because he's saying that the shelf rule doesn't work because of this point. She left. She never came back. So the fact of the matter is, I think whoever she talked to dropped the point with respect to trying to go effective that afternoon. But the shelf rule turbocharged capital formation. The finest compliment that was ever paid to me was, and I'm the division director that got it adopted. In other words, you had Ed Green proposing it, you had Leiby Spencer proposing it. Lee left in the early part of 1983, and I became the director, and he looked at me and he said, "Piece of cake, won't be a problem for you to get it adopted." Well, right after I became a division director, my boss, John Shad, gave a speech, which was just like John Whitehead's speech about liability under the shelf rule. He was, it's a speech that was fascinating to me because what he said was it was only a matter of time before you would have liability under the shelf rule, Section 11 liability. Now, what I find fascinating is, and knock on wood, the shelf rule was finally adopted in 1983. You haven't had this case that everybody said was going to happen. And the fact of the matter is, here I am going against my own boss, okay, the chairman, in terms of this point. And Barbara Thomas was a commissioner at the time, and she was against the shelf rule. And I acted as the honest, this is what I used to tell people when I was visiting their offices, I was the honest broker trying to get the shelf rule resolved, okay?
Did you do things like go talk to Barbara Thomas and explain
this? Oh, every day for a long time.
Did you get anywhere at all with her?
Not with Barbara, okay? But with John Shad, I did. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Yeah, I would think.
Well, I mean, go back to his speech. I mean, I'm objecting to my boss, okay? And again, that goes back to the culture point. I mean, what's really important is to understand that you can have an argument and still be friends. You can disagree with a superior, okay, and they can actually say, "I don't agree with you, but," or they can say, "Gee, I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt, and," or there's a whole bunch of different kinds of things, but none of them ever included, "That's the dumbest thing in the world, you're fired." Okay?
Yeah.
So the fact of the matter is, John Shad and I and Jim Treadwell, I mean, the whole commission at that time was intent on getting something resolved. And it was. Eventually it was resolved. But the fact is, shelf registration was the thing that changed the Euro market. The point about Alan Beller that I was alluding to before, the SEC Historical Society had a big panel on integration when Alan was the director of the division, and he said, and you can go back to the film for that because I think it was filmed, he said that he was in Europe at the time, and when shelf went permanent, which was the fall of 1983, you could hear the sucking sound as all of the money left Europe and went back to New York City. And that meant to me that was the proof of the pudding with respect to the point, which I knew at the time, but it was a confirmation that the shelf rule had done what it was supposed to do. The shelf rule was more than just the idea of being part of integration. It was getting the staff out of being a bottleneck with respect to capital formation.
Right.
And it was important for this balance between investor protection and capital formation, not to disadvantage capital formation. And the shelf rule was the way that that was done. Edgar was the way that, in essence, the staff got information. Go back to my point that I always wanted operations to be happy, okay? Because, quite frankly, as a former examiner, I ran the division as a division director as an examiner would run it, okay? If you were an examiner, how would you run the place? That was how I thought, okay? Every day, in every way, I tried to make it better for people in operations because, hey, those are the guys that do the work.
Right.
And so if they've got to look at this crazy little microfiche, okay, and go blind, okay, are they going to be happy?
Was Edgar, this is, you know, you talk about shelf registration going up in the fall of 83. This is pretty early in your time as director of the division. So you've had this special project and you've been sort of working on the nuts and bolts and as a technician to some respect. And at this point, you're the director of CorpFin. What was the, and you've got shelf registration up, which you say is the apex of integration. So these are big hurdles that you've jumped right at the beginning of your time.
Right.
What was the next big challenge? What did you have going forward? Was it Edgar?
Well, let's put it this way. Edgar started with a speech from Libby Spencer Jr. Okay. It was called The Electronic Library.
Right.
Okay. I commend that speech to you. Because in it, he posited what was really needed, okay? It didn't turn out to be a library. I mean, the fact of the matter is, Edgar was something when I got the promotion to be director shortly thereafter, John Shadd and I met, and he said, we want to do this, okay? John Shadd named Edgar, okay?
Oh.
No, it was a contest. John was a very wealthy man, and he ran a contest to name Edgar. And Edgar was named by a person named Charlie Schulquist. No, not Charlie Schulquist. Herbie Scholl. Herbie Scholl was the first, and until recently, the only head of the Edgar project, and Herbie got a $100 savings bond from John Shadd for naming Edgar. The fact of the matter was, Edgar was a personal project for John Shadd. And one time we went up to Congress to testify because Congress did not want to authorize any money for Edgar. And this was in front of John Dingell, and you had Schumer, Wyden, Markey, a whole bunch of people who are now senators. And at this hearing, I'm sitting to the right hand of my boss, okay? And we knew it was going to be bad. We didn't know how bad it was going to be. And we came into the room, and they had Edgar written on the wall. Okay, big letters. Okay, and I don't remember who was the person who led the charge from the House side, but the fact of the matter was they went through what Edgar was, electronic data gathering, analysis, and retrieval, and it said, well, you know, there's no way that it's going to retrieve, and so they took the R off. There's no way that it's going to analyze. They took the A off. There's no way it's going to gather, so they took the G off, and what was left was Ed. Okay, there was a TV program called Mr. Ed, which was a talking horse. Okay, and so they then had a movie of Mr. Ed, the talking horse. Okay, now my guy had just named Edgar. Okay, and you could be rest assured I had to hold him down. Okay, in terms of the point, because he didn't agree with any of this. And as we were leaving, he looked at me and he said, you know, I'll pay for it myself. Because he was so convinced. And see, having a chairman on your side, okay, and John, I mean, this was also, you talk about what the next wave was. Well, the next wave was the biggest IPO wave that we ever had, okay? I mean, in December of 1983, the division got over 180 IPOs filed in very short order. And when I first started out as an examiner, there were less than 175 in fiscal year 1975. So all of a sudden, the division, which at that time was no more than 300 people, okay, was literally inundated with filings. And for a while, the division, and see, there's a concept called interim lapse time, which is time from filing to first comment. And again, capital formation. Having a long period of time was not a good idea because the market was hot. And you had to still get your comments out, have them complied with. And the fact of the matter was, for a period of time in early 1984, the division did not review 10-Ks. The division only reviewed IPOs. And a very little known fact, but interim lapse time went down to 23 days. And I knew, okay, that I was in good shape when people started complaining that we were being too fast. In terms, in other words, investment bankers. And I would talk to people in terms of how are we doing, okay? And the fact of the matter is that was the answer, that we were just fine with respect to the point. And quite frankly, we did a lot of good with respect to disclosure. And see, if you take too long to do a review, you're not helping investors.
Right.
You have to. It's sort of like just-in-time kind of stuff. You have to do things in a right kind of fashion. The example I would give you is when I was there, tax shelters were still going on. There were lots of tax gimmicks that were that permeated the system. And I got a master's in tax from Georgetown, not to become a tax lawyer, but to become a better securities lawyer. But the fact of the matter is, I called up the IRS. I mean, I'm the SEC at that time. I'm a division director, okay? I'm having conversations with the Fed and with the Federal Home Loan Bank Board about, you know, Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina and savings and loans, so why not talk to the IRS about tax shelters? And Roscoe Egger was the commissioner of the IRS at the time, and there were these brand new tax gimmicks that were coming in that were being registered. The division's expertise with respect to tax was very limited. It used to have a special counsel in charge of tax. The person left, couldn't be replaced. Nobody wanted to come to work at the SEC and be a tax lawyer. But the fact of the matter was, I called up the IRS and got a meeting with Roscoe, first of all with his assistant, then with the commissioner. And I said, look, all the newspapers are writing these things up as tax scams, and I know enough about tax to know that in about 4 or 5 years, you will go after these people and get money. And I tried to make an arrangement with the Internal Revenue Service that if the Internal Revenue Service would help the division analyze these tax problems and, in essence, coordinate on this point, that would be a really good thing for investors because they won't be disadvantaged by losing their money 3-4 years from now. They'll know the disclosure that there's a tax risk now. Service was very enthusiastic about helping. We started talking about timing, and they looked at me and they said, you know, we can help you. And I said, great. How long will it take you to analyze a particular issue? And Mr. Egger said, 6 months at a minimum. They thought that they were being quick. I looked at them and I said, 6 weeks to 8 weeks is the only thing we can do. And on the timing question, it became the end. In other words,
couldn't do it.
Couldn't do it because the commission could not hold up filings for six right. weeks waiting for the service to come down from the mountain. Right. And the fact of the matter was, all of those filings, the staff put in, you know, the disclosure that they could with respect to warning this might actually have a tax problem. Well, they all sold anyway because by that time the market was taking off with abandon because once the market turned in the fall of 1983, John Shedd looked at me and he said, we're on the verge of the biggest bull market in history. And one thing he didn't do with respect to John Shedd was bet against him with respect to market moves, okay? Mm-hmm. He was always right with respect to market moves. Mm-hmm. And he started bringing people into my division because he wanted to make sure that Corp Fin took care of this matter. And so all of a sudden, I started getting slots from other divisions, and that's a good thing and a bad thing. People from Market Reg were not necessarily happy that they were losing slots, but Corp Fin was going up to 350, which it hadn't been at for a long time since Alan Levinson in the early 1970s. So when I left, the division was huge, relatively speaking.
And these are mostly just people looking at registration statements.
These are people examining registration statements, giving comments, and having analysts, lawyers, and accountants working together cross professions to get the best product that they possibly can.
And you've still got the system set up where you've got different people specializing. Somebody's doing airline, somebody's doing...
Yes, industry specialization was really hitting its... That's a very good point, because industry specialization started out in a... It wasn't easy, okay? Mm-hmm. But by the time the early to mid-1980s came, industry specialization was going like mad, okay? And coordination among and between the division and other offices was happening all the time. I mean, another night that I was there, another analyst walks in. I mean, go back to the point, accountants are there early, analysts and lawyers are there late. And he said, we got this problem with this company called Paradigm. Okay? And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, the Atlanta regional office has got an insider trading inquiry on it. They've left for the day. I can't do anything about it. What do you want me to do? Well, yeah, it's not on that sheet. But the fact of the matter is, it's a pretty good story. Paradigm was a case, was a filing, by the hottest computer company at the time. It was in Florida. It was not in Silicon Valley. Okay, there were lots of these situations. Okay, Eagle Computer was another one. Okay, but this one was one in which, as it turned out, okay, and see, you have to understand, if something is okay and the staff makes the determination that the disclosure is adequate, it's going to go through. If something's not and there's a problem, the staff's going to sit on it. Paradigm was sat on, okay? Mm. Because they did not give good answers to questions, and as it turned out, there wasn't a problem with respect to insider trading, at least not one that the staff was concerned about. As it turned out, and this was another enforcement referral, Paradigm had used somebody else's computer, which is now a company owned by Hewlett-Packard. It used to be a Texas company that Hewlett-Packard bought several years ago, a compact computer, and put a Paradigm name on it and did a request for proposals to the Social Security Administration for the biggest contract that SSA had ever done. They had phonied up a request for proposal. And their disclosure basically said, this contract will give us entree to government agencies because we're going to get the, we got this contract for $75 million with respect to the Social Security Administration. Well, the statement necessary to make the statement made not materially misleading is, oh, by the way, we might be debarred and we might never get another contract from the United States government. See, some of my best cases were cases that I brought on 12b-20. Okay, statements necessary to make the statements made, not materially misleading. The first MD&A case against Hutton was on that theory. They were kiting checks. Well, the commission didn't sue them on you were kiting checks and that's illegal. The commission sued them on if you ever stopped kiting checks, that was a known uncertainty, and so the statement necessary to make the statement made about your revenue was that you were kiting checks, and if you ever stopped kiting checks, all that revenue would go down by 17 to 20%. The same basic point was there with respect to Paradigm, because they had made the mistake of touting in their annual report, which was incorporated by reference into their registration statement, that they were going to knock the socks off of government contracting. Mm-hmm. Well, Harvey Pitt was the lawyer for Paradigm. And the fact of the matter was the commission did not allow Harvey to withdraw the registration statement. One of the things about jurisdiction is that there are things called stop orders and that sort of thing, but the staff just sat on it. They made a request to withdraw the registration statement, which, since nothing had been sold, would have taken all of the Section 17 of the 33 Act away from the case. And at that time, I was coordinating with enforcement again, okay, with respect to the point. And we went up to the commission, and literally the commission was asked to overrule me with respect to the idea of withdrawing the registration statement. The commission sided with me, and if you look at the case, it's a Section 17 case.
So you want to keep the registration statement that you're sitting on?
Yes, because there's an ongoing offer. In other words, Section 17, which is the anti-fraud provision of the 33 Act, which has got a negligence standard in it, okay, allows you to sue for an offer and sale. Now, 10b-5 under blue chip stamps is a purchase and sale. So there was no 10b-5 action here because people had not sold off of the registration statement.
I got you.
So the idea of withdrawing the registration statement took the case out of people's hands. Mm-hmm. Okay. Significantly, I mean, I did a lot of work at the SEC. This was the only registration statement where the underwriters personally called me up and thanked me for stopping it, because literally you stopped a bunch of blue chip investment banking firms from having a real problem with respect to Paradigm. Paradigm doesn't exist anymore. And so throughout this time period, the focus of the division went to, I mean, integration was, in 1984, S4 came in. And S4 was, in essence, the perfect example of integration, because you took the concepts of an S3, S2, S2 doesn't exist anymore, but an S3 company, an S1 company, and you literally put that into a registration statement. So if the acquirer was an S3 company and the acquiree was a S1 company, that was the quantum of the disclosure in the S4. If they were both S3 companies, the merger proxy was really short, okay, because they could both incorporate by reference. Mm-hmm. And by this time, okay, by the early 1980s, investment bankers had concluded that incorporation by reference was not bad. They could have all of the stuff that they didn't want incorporated by reference, and then they could have their sales material, okay, in there as well. And so integration, okay, was, go back to the S16 point, took off like a bandit, because shelf registration turbocharged the offering process. S3 allowed it to be done quickly. You could have a 12-page prospectus if you wanted. And the fact of the matter is you put the two of them together and it went faster than a speeding bullet. Okay, and everything that literally you see today in terms of the offering process on public offerings was built, and the foundation was put into place at that time in terms of things like exchange offers. At that time, a tender offer in which the consideration is a security is an exchange offer. S4 dealt with merger proxies and exchange offers, but there was no exemptive authority on the staff. That came later. And so the idea of putting cash tender offers on the same same platform as an exchange offer was not something that happened until the commission got exemptive authority. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, if you want a regret, the regret that I had was that I couldn't get exchange offers to be at the same time as, on the same platform as cash offers. But Dennis Garris, when he became the chief of the office, I got to know Dennis Garris, and I remember one day he called me up and he said, "John, I finally did it. They're now equal." And so the fact of the matter is, this point about the staff being a family, this point about the staff working together, thinking together, transcends generations. I mean, Dennis Garris was years after the time that I was there, but he knew that what happened in the early 1980s with respect to S4 was not the end of the game, and he took up the cudgels and he actually got it done. And so that's the kind of, in essence, coordination between staff people over periods, over generations.
Did you bring up Linda Quinn to take over after you? Is that right?
Linda Quinn was... Linda Quinn came from Sullivan & Cromwell, and there was an office that Ernestine Zappoi headed up. It was sort of an office that was supposed to assist and was a quality control office in the division. There was a number of senior people that Ernie and I made. Ernie was the first associate director who became who was an accountant. And after her position there, she came in as a professional accounting fellow, professional attorney fellow, okay, and then became permanent staff. I think that's right. Either that or she was permanent staff to begin with. But the fact of the matter is she then came to disclosure policy and disclosure policy for integration. She did SK. Mm-hmm. And Linda and I worked together for the entire time that we were there, okay, in disclosure policy. And we had, I mean, I'll give you an example. I mean, one of the, we used to have these knockdown, drag-out arguments about the law, okay? But we were still friends. And the fact is, there was one letter, the American Council of Life Insurance letter, which was one of the most important letters for integration because, in essence, what this letter said was that you could have, you could register a private placement, in essence, and it was still a public offer, okay? Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter was that the people who bought a tranche off the shelf were not a statutory underwriter. We had a meeting between Lee and Linda and myself, and I basically wanted this letter because it helped integration, and Linda opposed it, and the letter went out. It's the American Council of Life Insurance letter signed by Lee Spencer, but Linda and I were still friends. Yeah. And Linda was a brilliant lawyer. Linda, after I became the director, I made her the associate director of legal, and then she got the attention of Mr. Shad, and she went upstairs to be the executive assistant to the chairman, and when I left, she became the director.
Did you give her this exchange offer thing and say, you know,
oh, no, no.
We want to do this some.
The exchange offer thing, the most important thing that, that Linda and I talked about when I left was that the division at that time was in really good shape, and I'm not saying I did it, okay? I'm saying that it was a progression of people from the late 1970s to the middle 1980s. And the most important thing that that Linda and I talked about was operations was a well-oiled machine at that time. I mean, it literally ran, okay? And when you're thinking about how Corp Fin works, you have to keep in mind that operations is the heart of the process. It's not interpretations. It's not rulemaking. I mean, I got to be a senior person by going outside of operations, okay, mm-hmm. and going through rulemaking, which at that time people just didn't do, okay? Mm-hmm. If you wanted to distinguish yourself, you went to the chief counsel's office or you went through operations. I went outside the box, and the fact is when Linda and I were working together, both of us had a very similar view of the law, okay, with certain minor exceptions like the American Council of Life Insurance. But the fact of the matter is what was important was that you could disagree with a person and still be friends. Mm-hmm. And I always wanted, and this was something that I, a philosophy that I followed all the time, if I'm going to have a problem, I want to know about it before I walk into a commission meeting room. And Linda was perfect at making sure that, you know, if I had a problem, she would tell me. She took great pride in telling me I had a problem. And I appreciated that, okay? It wasn't the kind of situation where, gee, Linda, I don't want you to tell me what's wrong.
Right.
I wanted to know what was wrong, okay? Right. Because, A, you got a better product that way, and, B, you were far more successful. And in the mid-1980s, the division was, I mean, first of all, you had the biggest bull market in history. Go see John Shad.
Right.
Second of all, there was no Louis Law's Code anymore because the commission had basically done integration. Third, the commission was doing studies like the study on tender offers, okay? And the fact of the matter is, I mean, the division had its hands on every aspect of the capital raising process. Mm-hmm. So I left and I, you know.
Why did you decide to leave?
Well, most people left the commission when their kids needed braces, okay?
Yeah. Or going to college or something.
I left because my kids were going to college.
Okay.
And SES bonuses helped you with respect to braces, but there was a fellow by the name of Paul Gonson. I'm going to now tell a story about Paul Gonson. Paul Gonson and I used to teach together. We taught together for years at American University, and we used to always drive home. And Paul had two sons, Ben and Max. And when Paul took out his third mortgage, I didn't even know you could take out a third mortgage for education, okay? Mm-hmm. I thought to myself, there's no way that I'm going to do that. So when my son was getting toward going to college, I knew that that was about it for me. And quite frankly, Linda was the director for almost 10 years, and I was the next preceding director for 10 years. I thanked her all the time for not leaving. And the fact of the matter was, I could predict what the division's position was because Linda and I had worked together so well. And the idea of her taking over from me for this division, I knew it was in good hands. Matter of fact, I knew it was in great hands because I knew that she would do the exact right thing by the Division of Corporation Finance.
Terrific. Is there anything that we haven't touched on that we should hit before we wrap it up?
Restatements. I want to talk about restatements. Go back a second to Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina. I had a chief accountant. His name was Howard P. Hodges. Howard P. Hodges was an old line accountant, and I had lots of people who were older than me. Okay, I mean, I left the division at the age of 38. I became the director at the age of 34, 35. Okay, I was a kid. Howard Hodges was my chief accountant. And the fact of the matter was, when Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina happened, he came into my office and said that he had gone into public accounting in the 1950s, and that at that time it was Venezuela, okay? And these were all troubled debt restructurings, okay? And the fact of the matter was, he was concerned that these countries were getting better treatment than companies, domestic companies, would get. We did a series of staff accounting bulletins, and at that time, the director had to sign staff accounting bulletins. One of the things that caused me to get interested in accounting was the fact that I had to actually sign a staff accounting bulletin, which, if you want to look at 302-906 certifications today, having to sign something actually crystallizes the brain. But the fact of the matter is, I got involved with accounting through Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina and savings and loans, but then things started to go into other areas. There was an article in Fortune magazine about Aetna. Aetna was a very big insurance company, and the fact of the matter was that it had a huge net operating loss carry forward. At that time, go back to the tax point, at that time an NOL was a huge kind of benefit.
Right.
And Fortune magazine questioned the utility of this NOL. Okay. Well, the commission staff reads the newspapers. Okay. We read magazines. We did a review. This was Howard Morin's office. He was the assistant director. And the fact of the matter was that what was at issue here was APB 11, paragraph 11, with respect to whether the NOL was realizable. Go back to that point that I bought the three volumes. This was smack dab in the middle of those three volumes. I knew this cold, okay? The fact of the matter was it said beyond a reasonable doubt. You could keep the NOL if its realizability was beyond a reasonable doubt. Okay, well, the company and its accounting firm, and I won't get personal here, but the company and the accounting firm were adamant that it was realizable, okay? Had huge meetings. The fact of the matter was, beyond a reasonable doubt, sort of stuck in my mind. So I had, and this is before the internet, this is before word searches, this is before anything, okay? I had a bunch of lawyers read all of GAAP to find every instance where beyond a reasonable doubt was used. Hmm. There were three. And in none of those instances was beyond a reasonable doubt more than a 50% standard. It was in the neighborhood of 90% plus. And so the fact of the matter is we had a meeting with the company and the accounting firm. The head of the accounting firm subsequently became a chief accountant of the commission. And I pointed out that beyond a reasonable doubt in this context was more than 90%. And therefore, while they surely had made the case that it was more than 50%, they hadn't made the case that this was a slam dunk.
Hmm.
Okay? There was a restatement. And the fact of the matter was, it was an exceptional situation to restate. Okay? Clarence Sampson, the chief accountant, when I was division director, had a philosophy that the registrant won a tie. Okay, I firmly believe that. A registrant should win a tie. A restatement should only occur when it's wrong, and it's wrong to a material extent. The point of my story, and the reason why I'm saying this, is now we have hundreds of restatements every year. Okay?
Right.
And I can tell you that this is a wrong thing to do. You're not helping investors, okay, by having hundreds of restatements. If everybody has one, then they don't distinguish themselves, okay? If there are very few and far between, they stick out and are memorable. And I was at a meeting recently where I basically said, you know, APB 11, you know, used to say this, and all of the guys who were my age remembered the Aetna restatement, and they all said, yeah, that was a big one. But you can't think of restatements today in the same vein because there are so many of them.
Right.
And so part of the job of the Division of Corporation Finance is to make those decisions, to make those calls, and to only make the call about a restatement when it really is wrong and really is material, because that sends the right message to investors.
Well, terrific. Well, I appreciate you walking through all this material with me. It's been great.
Anytime.
Thank you.
It was a lot of fun.